the more we know about the, how the primate brain works, the more ideas we will have for how to develop general flexible forms of artificial intelligence, should we want to do such a thing. I want something I think is a beautiful idea.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Paul Middlebrooks. Today, I bring you Mark Humphreys, who runs a neural data lab. That means he's a systems neuroscientist who uses statistics and computational models to study the brain, and he does it with other people's data. So he's one of an emerging breed of what are called neural data scientists. Mark and I discuss his recent paper that asks the question, what does the brain learn to remember? They found that just as rats learn a new rule while they perform a maze task, ensembles or groups of neurons in the prefrontal cortex temporarily synchronize their activity. So we chat about what this means with respect to things like how a single neuron contributes to brain function and how more long-term learning is thought to take place via synaptic plasticity. Mark also writes an excellent blog on Medium, which is a project of his to bring systems neuroscience to the public, and that's actually how I discovered him through a few of his articles. So we chat about a few of his pieces there, one of which asks the question, will AI suffer from mental disorders that we suffer from, especially since we don't understand those mental disorders yet? And if everything goes right, your kids might one Christmas day be listening to some science lectures delivered by a neural data scientist named Mark Humphreys. That'll make more sense later. All the show notes are available at braininspired.co. Feel free to connect with me on Twitter. I'm at PGMID, PGMID. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy Mark Humphreys. Okay, I have with me Mark Humphreys. He's a principal investigator in his lab at the University of Nottingham in the UK. Thanks for being with me today, Mark.
Thanks, Paul.
So here's the plan. We're going to work our way from neuroscience to artificial intelligence during our conversation by way of how you approach what you do. So you call your lab a neural data lab, and you're a neural data scientist. Now, once upon a time, there was no such thing as a neural data scientist. And then something happened and you came to fruition. So what does that mean? And how did your species come into existence?
I think that the species has been around for a while, just hidden. It's this intersection of the fact that the amount of data being made available from neuroscience experiments, particularly in our case, systems neuroscience experiments, experiments of recording many tens or hundreds or thousands of neurons at the same time. This kind of data has been increasing exponentially in the last decade. And the ability of the people gathering that data to make sense of it is limited by not just by the amount of time they have available, as much as the skill sets you need don't overlap, particularly between recording the data and analyzing the data. So a bigger and bigger niche has opened up for people who have subject knowledge about neuroscience to understand what the data means, but have the analytical skills to tackle that scale of data with cutting edge machine learning or other time series approaches to these kinds of data. So it's that gap which with the neural data scientist sits, somewhere with essentially someone who's doing science on data, but doesn't get that data themselves. They're asking their own questions of the data.
Yeah, so coming from an experimental lab background where I did the experiments with non-human primates and analyzed the data, I am ravenously jealous of your position here to analyze the data, because the experimentation takes so much time and actually takes so much out of you while you're doing the experiment that at the end of the day, just focusing on the analyses is not something that you look forward to.
Right.
So congratulations on positioning yourself well there.
So I would say it's a relay race, right? The incredible effort it takes to get good quality neural recordings is a highly admirable skill set, and it's, yeah, as you say, it's exhausting. And most modern experimental data sets are so rich that, of course, once the original lab have answered their initial question with that data, there are many other questions we can ask of that data that they simply don't have the time, resources, or possibly interest even to look at those questions. So it's there in that field of we can take that data on and do the next set of questions that drives the need for this kind of data lab as much as the sort of both bilateral collaboration where we're working directly on new data. So we do both kind of things, but there's a clear niche for taking existing data further.
You know, as a graduate student, I was invited to give a talk, and it was the department was heavily a modeling department. And during the lunch after the talk, we were sitting around the table, and they kept asking me, you know, why don't neuroscientists want to give their data to us and just let us model the data? And I found myself becoming defensive and saying, you don't understand how hard this data is to get. And I might have time to analyze this data in a myriad of ways. And of course, I never did. I still haven't. So I think that there is a real need to collaborate. But how open do you find labs? How hard is it to get the data? You know, are there different types of labs that are more willing to give you their data than others?
As you say, I think it's partly a sort of implicit trust issue that if you've got a set of data that's really hard won, you've built the rig, you've spent the weeks and months, you've done the surgery, you're doing the recordings, you've done all the long hours to get the data, the prospect of handing it over to someone who doesn't understand anything about the data can be a little, it doesn't have to strike you as something that strongly motivates you to do. So, in fact, one of the written down principles on my lab principles Google Doc is all data will be respected to the utmost, that the effort put into getting it is the thing we'll cherish. But then it's partly a bootstrapping process of showing that you can do excellent things with existing data, and then people will then... So, for example, my initial paper on methods of clustering spike trains was all built on data that was openly available or had come from other sources without me going to them directly, so they could demonstrate a decent publication with usage of existing data.
Yeah.
Which then Elsie then says, okay, so this person now knows, you know, they know how to handle, they understand the data, they know how to handle it, know what it means. So it's a good basis for a collaboration, or saying, yes, when you ask for the data, we know you know what you're doing.
Yeah, you have to get that first ask accepted, and then you prove yourself with it. So it's proof of principle.
Right.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and just jump in and talk about one of your, actually, your most recent publication in Nature Communications. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
I'll read the title in a second, but I was wondering if someone may have pitched this alternative title, which I'll pitch to you now. How about, Ye Matter But Little, Single Neuron?
Yes, that is one of the themes of the paper. It's slightly hidden in the version that was finally released, but yes.
Right, okay. Well, the actual paper is called An Ensemble Code in Medial Prefrontal Cortex Links Prior Events to Outcomes During Learning.
Yeah.
Do you want to just tell me a little bit about what you guys found?
Sure. So this paper was looking at prefrontal cortex and the fact that of the many roles prefrontal cortex is thought to have, two of the dominant roles are one in short-term memory, holding things in mind that you need to remember to action. And on the other hand, a known role in understanding the relationships of things in the world about what actions lead to what outcomes. So we had a set of data from rats learning new rules on a maze and recording some prefrontal cortex while they were learning this process. So we were asking what contribution, if anything, does short-term memory have in the learning of new rules in a maze? Because naively, you would think that you need short-term memory so that you have some memory of what you just did to guide what you're about to do next. And the better you remember whether the previous thing you did was good or not, the more likely you are to do it again and learn the association between what you did and the outcome. In these rats running on this maze, it's a Y-shaped maze. They ran up the first arm, they had to choose a left or the right arm, and one of them was rewarded. And when they got to the end and ate the reward, they had to then trudge all the way back to the start again, just turn around and walk back. Rats hate turning around and walking back. It took them about a minute to do this. So every time they walk back, we have about a minute of activity in prefrontal cortex, in which we could ask, what was it thinking about while this rat trudged all the way back to the start? Was it remembering stuff that just happened? And how did that memory appear? Did it appear at the start of learning, at the end of learning, or did it appear in the middle? Where did it come?
The original study was a study about sleeping and replaying activity, right? So just curious, how did you come up with the idea of analyzing the walk back period?
So our starting point was interested in encoding by ensembles of neurons. So we wanted to look at when the actual ensemble appeared during learning. So an actual addressing the actual cell assembly question of when does the set of cells assemble into an ensemble. And then it struck us that because there was this very clear, distinct stages of the trial where it has to make a choice, and then this long period where it walks back, we have the possibility of ensembles encoding come two completely separate things. In the trial, the prospective decision, and then in the walk back, this retrospective potential memory. So we looked at both of those, and the first thing we looked at was the memory. Now we're looking at the decision part. The idea was to, because this data set is quite unique in the fact that the recordings were done from the very first session that the animal was placed in the maze. So you can see the prefrontal cortex activity changing during learning. So the obvious question was, how does it change in a memory component? So the first thing to show was, is there a memory component? Does it remember things about what just happened? And the answer was yes. It remembered what direction it had chosen, and it remembered whether there was a good or bad outcome to that choice. And it remembered that from the very first session that it was put in the maze. So prefrontal cortex didn't need to learn to remember.
So what you found is that once the rat did learn, or as the rat actually learned, this ensemble of prefrontal cortex neurons would come online. You actually looked at the way that all of these different simultaneously recorded neurons were covarying, essentially.
Right.
Do I have this right? That one of the big findings was that it didn't matter so much what individual neurons were doing. They didn't contribute so much to the correlating with the learning, but it mattered a lot more how all the neurons were active together.
Right. So the thing that was most clearly predictive of the fact that the animal was about to learn, to actually clearly acquire the rule, was that in this walk back to the start, the same pattern of synchronization across the neurons would show up, which in our interpretation was that what's happening was it was synchronizing the remembered information. So we always had a memory of the outcome. We always had a memory of the direction, sometimes a memory of the light. But those neurons representing these things were not synchronized in memory until just before learning.
And this happened right after reinforcement was delivered.
Right. So the reinforcement delivered, and then you can see as it trudged back to the start, the memory was fading as it got closer to the start.
Mm.
And had no relationship at all to the future choice or outcome or the next trial. It was entirely what had just happened.
Which is surprising.
Yes.
So you talk about in the paper, you talk about how these ensembles of neurons are candidate functional cell assemblies. Why would these cell assemblies be important, and what are they?
So we think in this case, the cell assembly is the synchronization of information that's encoded in separate groups of neurons. So in this case, the memory of the direction that was chosen and the outcome that happened was encoded across the population of neurons, but the actual activity between wasn't synchronized until just before learning. So this synchronization is the cell assembly, and we were asking whether that synchronization was then something relatively permanent, as in it was something that could be related to synaptic plasticity, or whether it's something that just appeared temporarily and went away again. So it was used to guide learning, but wasn't necessary for performance. And in as far as we could tell, it was very much a temporary thing. The idea of the functional rather than this structural cell assembly. So maybe it was driven by a change in neuromodulation of prefrontal cortex. Maybe it was temporary coupling from hippocampus. But whatever it was there for a handful of trials, and then it went away again.
Okay, so presumably these were naive rats. So they were working hard at the beginning to learn the task and the reinforcement contingency. So I wonder how these ensembles would maintain or change as the rats became experts at the task.
Right. So these, at least in these ensembles in this memory period, as it's walking back to the start, they did appear to be very temporary things, just lasting for a few minutes at most, with no trace, as it turns out, we've analyzed the data further, there's no trace of them then in sleep after the behavior session. Whereas we're now analyzing also the trial itself, where it's making the decision between left and right arm. And we can see a similar ensemble appearing in the trial just before learning. But we see trace of that ensemble inside sleep. So there appears to be a separation of the ensembles that encode future and past information, and only the future information is seemingly maintained on a more permanent basis.
Oh, interesting. And I'm also curious, I guess this is where being just on the neural data analysis side of things, that you guys can't manipulate the experiment yourselves. You can't manipulate the ensemble to see what happens. But are you rooting for this in their lab? Are you asking them to do things like this?
Yeah, so we're hoping that at some point, yes. Either in... so this data came from Adrian Peyrache, who's now at the Montreal Neurological Institute. He's continuing to do work on prefrontal cortex. It would be nice, yes, to have either him or some of the other collaborators in prefrontal cortex work take a look at these ensembles, although because of the transitory nature of the memory ones, one can imagine setting up an experiment to manipulate them would be quite tricky.
But. Yeah, right. Well, so that's cool. I mean, this paper shows how important neural networks are and how relatively unimportant single neurons are. But you've written about how to study networks in the brain and how to use network theory to study neural ensembles and circuits in the brain. Can you just tell me quickly what network theory is and how it differs from graph theory?
Okay. That one's straightforward. So essentially graph theory is the math side, network theory is the applied side. They both deal with the objects either called graphs or networks. So where you have nodes representing things, so nodes representing people, or in this case neurons, and the links between the nodes representing interactions between those things. So in graph theory, it's a pure math side of just analyzing the properties of these networks, these graphs, how they change when you add more links, how they break apart when you remove nodes, that kind of thing. And network theory is really graph theory applied to data.
I see. So when I think network theory, I envision sort of a modern machine learning network as well. So you have single units connected by weighted connections. And I suppose network theory subsumes those types of networks. Is that right?
So network theory is really focused on the topology rather than the dynamics. So there is a whole now field of within network theory that's putting dynamics on the networks to examine the implications of different topologies. So whether it's the networks are modular or sparse or strongly connected or scale-free or whatever the different structure is, and the implications that has for dynamics. Then it starts to overlap with the things we understand to be is either neural networks from AI or networks as we construct them in computational neuroscience of sets of neurons linked together to create dynamics. So I guess the more clear separation is that the network theory is based on the topology. And so you could describe a recurrent neural network, its actual connectivity as a network in network theory. But of course, the actual dynamics on it are supposed to be solving some kind of task, which is not anything the network theory is concerned with.
I see. Okay. So let's just go over some of the advantages and challenges of using network theory to study systems neuroscience. And this comes from your paper in 2017, arguing to use network theory to study systems neuroscience. For example, one advantage is that if you have a network, proposed network, you can compare it to null network models that are already known to test hypotheses.
Right. Yes. So I've touched on this on the top of these already. So there are well-established models for whole classes of different types of networks. So for example, the small word networks already mentioned. There's lots of models you can generate versions of scale-free networks, lots of models to generate versions of networks which are modular, have groups inside them. Models that you can generate non-models for so-called core periphery networks, where you expect a bunch of the nodes are strongly connected together and everything else is weakly connected to them, and other variants thereof. So all of these models mean that you can fit them or approximate them to your data. and ask how much does your data depart from that generative class and model. Of course, if it is explained exactly by the generative class and model, then you've learned an awful lot about your data.
Right.
So unlike most approaches in neural data analysis, if you describe your time series as a network, you then have a whole class of null models to say, does the interactions between this set of neurons correspond to any of these class of generative models? And if it does it depart in interesting ways? What do we learn in terms of the structure of the dynamics? So that lets us not only understand something about the structure of the interaction between the neurons, but also lets us track the changes in those interactions over time. So we can use them as the non-models as normalization tools to say how much, not just does something change in the data, but it does its departure from the model change.
I see. And another, getting back to my question about being able to manipulate or perturb the ensemble neurons in the medial prefrontal cortex of those rats, one of the things that you can do with these networks is quantify what changes happen once you perturb it in different ways.
Yes, right. So it makes it very clear. So obviously the networks we're talking about in terms of analyzing neural data are each node in the network is a time series of one time series of neural activity, so putatively a neuron. And each link is going to be some measure of interaction between neurons, so whether that be a simple correlation coefficient or something more complicated. So with that in hand, then yes, we can take some of the tools of network theory, like looking at the weight and degree distributions, and you very easily pick out what are the putatively most dominant neurons in driving the interactions in this, in our recording. And they will be obviously then be a prime target to go and perturb to test causality in whatever the task is you're got the data from.
Well, that's very good. But you point out in the paper, this is not a magic wand yet, network theory, and that there are some challenges that we face. One of the ones that I appreciate that you pointed out is that neural circuits are highly dynamic. And you talked about being able to track the dynamics over time in these things, but actual neural circuits, the resolution of their dynamics is much faster than what we can currently record. So there's going to be some missing information there, perhaps.
Right. Yes. So, So I was trying to be careful in the paper to talk to make clear the distinction between the description of the time series as a network, separate from the description of the actual connections between the neurons as a network. Because we can always, ideally, we'd have some sort of ground of truth, which would be the actual network of synaptic connections between the neurons that we're recording from. One of the points being made there was that those synaptic connections, because of short-term plasticity like facilitation or because of changing failure rates or because of change of state of the actual network itself, the effective connectivity between the neurons can change much faster than we can track from recording individual spikes, because spikes are very sparse and slow in large populations compared to the changes to the synapses. So yeah, so there's an inherent limit there with looking at spikes. In the long term, in the decade or two, the solution is presumably going to be that we're going to have widespread recordings of voltage-sensitive dyes, so we can record the sub-threshold voltages of populations of neurons instead of just the spikes. And then if that's the case, then we can properly track the very quick changes in synaptic connectivity between the neurons.
I'm assuming you think that that's going to be a game changer in how we study the brain?
Yeah, right. So we've done work on aplysia, on sea slug locomotion dynamics, in which the neurons have been recorded using voltage-sensitive dyes. So we have all the spikes and potentially, although it's hard to get at the moment, sub-threshold membrane voltages. So we can already see that that gives us so much extra information about what's going on in the circuit than the spikes, because, of course, every spike coming out of one neuron just has a very small effect on its targets. It changes, the postsynaptic potential is very small compared to the size of the spike. But if you could see those postsynaptic potentials, then we can infer a lot about the actual structure of the network and infer how it's changing on short timescales as well as long timescales. And would open up all kinds of abilities to test theories that we can't currently get at.
Well, this actually opens up to me how I discovered you, which was through your the blog that you've been writing via Medium. One of the articles that I enjoyed from there. I'd like to just go over a few of them because they're pretty entertaining and well written. So I recommend anyone, I'll link to it in the show notes. I recommend anyone go read your articles on Medium as well. One of the themes that I hope to maintain on this show is to directly compare real brain networks with artificial neural networks of machine learning systems like deep learning. And neural networks, as we've been talking about, are inspired by the brain, with each unit representing a single neuron. So in the neural network, lots of inputs converge on a given unit and through some function work together to activate that unit in artificial neural networks. Now, you've written about how each pyramidal neuron in our brain is itself already a two-layer network. Can you describe briefly what you mean there?
Right. Yeah. Okay. So this is the idea that a given cortical pyramidal neuron has a very large dendrite sticking out the top of it, which branches considerably. So it looks very much like a tree. So it's a long trunk, and then it branches and branches again away from this trunk. And we know from careful recordings in the dendrites themselves that synaptic inputs to little bits of these dendrites, these individual branches, they don't add up in a linear fashion. So one or two inputs will have a very weak effect. Three or more inputs can have a very strong effect. So there's this big jump between the response to a couple and response to a few inputs coming in simultaneously. It's this so-called dendritic spike thing. And because these branches act relatively independently, it means that each branch has this ability to non-linearly sum its inputs so it can jump from this almost zero to one state, and then that information is transmitted down to the cell body. So it is as though there is a neural network layer sitting in the dendrites, which then points at an output layer sitting in the body. Because the each individual branch's output looks almost exactly like you have the sigmoid function or tanh function you have on many many units in deep and classic artificial neural networks and deep neural networks.
Yeah, so you have this subunit computation on the dendritic spines, and this also touches back on the dynamics being so much faster than what we're recording, or through the spikes, what we're even recording. So you have all of these processes, and you write in the brain that basically now your brain is 17 billion computers. Or your cortex, rather, 17 billion computers, which is great. Does it matter, do you think, that AI networks, machine learning networks, ignore much of the brain, even if they think that they aren't?
So if the goal is to solve particular focused problems, so particular benchmark data sets, or to solve very narrowly focused problems, then it's likely that there will be good engineering solutions that don't need to reference the brain to solve those problems. Because after all, the brain is, even the human brain, is just a collection of different solutions to many different problems. But it strikes me that if the goal of your artificial intelligence that you want to build, your deep neural network or your convolutional neural network or your recurrent neural network, is to do something flexible and more general, then we only have one example to guide us, which is the primate brain. So the more we know about how the primate brain works, the more ideas we will have for how to develop general flexible forms of artificial intelligence, should we want to do such a thing.
Well, it's a really good segue, actually, to the next Medium article that I wanted to touch on. Thinking about general AI and all the subtle complexities that it's going to take, you have a wonderful article. You write that we have a pretty good handle on the neural basis of things like movement disorders, but how we know still very little about mental disorders like schizophrenia and OCD. And you ask in the article, and now I ask you, Mark, will mental disorders such as those manifest in any type of general AI that we build? Should we worry about that?
Yeah, so my question was, if we don't know the crucial aspect of the human brain that leads it to manifest these complicated thought disorders, these kind of disorders that we don't see in any other species, then how do we avoid the same fate for any general AI that we build? So to touch on a couple of examples in the piece, one of which was, see, many of these disorders are linked to aberrant wiring problems in the brain. So schizophrenia and others are linked to problems with synaptic connectivity and the fact that maybe things are either over connected or under connected. So it raises the question of, okay, so when we have a general purpose AI network and it is adding and pruning its own connections, how do you stop it from making links between things that make no sense, and thereby creating its own hallucinations or inability to connect things together properly in what would be its form of thought disorders? I mean, after all, we already have deliberately built examples of artificial neural networks that can hallucinate, right? That you feed in their own output back into their input, and they create dreamlike sequences of images. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other alternative is that for many of these thought disorders are linked to forms of neuromodulation. So schizophrenia has aspects that link to dopamine, for example. And the things that neuromodulators do in driving how the brain works, so for example, either changing the balance of activity or guiding plasticity in particular. Obviously, many of those things are recapitulated in, or will have to be recapitulated, presumably in general purpose AI somehow, mm-hmm. to make it learn and flexible. So opens the question of, okay, so what happens if there is not enough of your, or too much of your thing that's standing in for dopamine in your system? Will the balance of activity mean that the input is then fragmented and no longer giving a sensible output?
One of the issues that I thought of, I mean, your article raises a lot of questions, obviously. So a lot of creativity comes from features that might coexist with what we consider mental disorders. And, you know, I'm wondering how much of these we should consider bugs and how much we should consider features if we create a general AI that presumably would need to have some sort of creativity built in.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, it's true that people have linked various forms of creativity either to aberrant thought processes or to constraints placed on brains by problematic processing. So classic examples being the number of high-achieving dyslexics, in particularly in art, that the compensation somehow for the inability to read and process information that way has expressed itself as a artistic form. Yeah, it is a very good question. I think one of the problems is that it's likely that in a given, as we know from building just randomly wired networks of artificial neurons, computational neuroscience type models of you know, recurrent neural networks, that you wire them up one randomly in one way, it's chaotic. You change that wiring very subtly, it becomes stable. You change it again, it becomes chaotic again. And the separation between a chaotic state and a stable state is very, very, very close to each other.
Yeah.
So if it's if some form of you know, unconstrained processes are needed for creativity, then moving the system, being able to control the system's movement between the two, I guess, would be key to controlled creativity rather than just untrammeled thought disorders.
Yeah, it made me think. Your article made me think a lot about, you know, whether it's more amazing that, you know, there are many mental disorders made possible by just how complex and how chaotic the cortex can be, or that with all that complexity, it's the brain and our minds are so relatively well constrained that there are actually relatively few mental disorders. Relative to how many we could have, maybe we should be thankful.
Yeah, I guess that is, yes. Yes, also we don't really appreciate what is the sort of limiting case of the number of possible ways that a cortex of the complexity of the human cortex could go wrong. And perhaps there are many, many more ways it could go wrong than it does currently go wrong. And yes, that the really strongly detrimental, the sort of the clinically severe levels of thought disorders are still relatively rare. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I'm mindful of your time here, but I'd like to ask you a few rapid fire questions and then go ahead and conclude. So, Mark, is there anything that you wish was on your CV that's not yet?
Okay. Yeah. A couple of things, quick things. So one, from the science side, on my CV at some point, I want something I think is a beautiful idea. Mm. So we've got lots of nice projects, lots of nice ideas, but nothing I currently looking at and going, yes, that is my beautiful idea. That's the one where I'm thinking that's my contribution.
Yeah. Awesome.
And then the other is the dream one day is to, the far future, is to do the things called the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures. So the Royal Institution in London was set up in the early 19th century to educate the public in science. And it's been running its Christmas lectures now for over 150 years. So this Michael Faraday gave the first set. So the high point of a British scientist trying to do public outreach is to give the Christmas lectures at the Royal Institution and talk about your subject to excited school children for 3 days solid and have it televised.
Oh, that's so cool. Well, I'll pull some strings for you. I'm sure that I can help you in that endeavor. That's great. So what do you think is something that we'll learn about the brain or the mind because of artificial intelligence research?
At the moment, I think we're relearning old lessons. So obviously the deep neural network research in particular is reemphasizing the fact that you can get neurons that seem to encode for particular things like faces or place emerge from general learning rules. There's no need to propose a specific class of neurons exist to do this job. They just emerge. So that actually actually everything that's encoded in the brain is encoded on a continuum. And indeed, also we had more recent demonstrations from DeepMind of encoding in deep networks that you can find the individual units that clearly encode for specific properties of an image, take all those out, and the performance of the network doesn't degrade because obviously it's massively redundantly encoded in the rest of the network. So that kind of lesson of moving away in neuroscience from this idea that there's a cell that does a particular tuned function is a contribution. And the idea that lots of simple units can do complex things, of course.
Yeah, I feel like we're really on the, on the cusp of that because, I grew up in my PhD program learning all about receptive fields in, visual neurons. And that's still kind of the way that I think about it. And there's got to be crosstalk in between those. And I think that we're kind of getting away from that and realizing how complex. I mean, you see that in prefrontal cortex neurons, for instance, that, these mixed selectivity properties of the neurons that can do lots of different things. And like in your ensembles recorded in medial prefrontal cortex, how the neurons can overlap in different networks and different ensembles and contribute to in different ways. So I think that's a really good answer to the question. What's something that you wish you knew going into neuroscience research?
The thing you touched on at the start, how hard it is to get the data. So as a theorist, that's something you learn really slowly, if at all. So if you spend your life in a computer science or a physics department doing just theory, you never really get a handle on how hard it is to get the data. So I was lucky that I was trained in a psychology department where the floor above us was just full of animal neuroscience research. So we got to understand a lot about how hard it was, and it went on a lot of lab visits and sat in on recording sessions just to get a really good feel for how hard it is to get high quality data and all the unwritten problems that are in the way, right? All the things that don't appear in method sections, you just can't get from reading the papers.
Oh, you're really winning me over here, warming my heart. I think I'm going to go ahead and just send you my data right when we get off of the call here. Hey, so finally, so we've talked about how the neural data scientist was born and how you currently approach figuring out how the brain works and some of the challenges therein. My last question is, how do you envision your role, that is the role of the neural data scientist, changing or developing over time with respect to both neuroscience and the advent of the convergence, let's say, of neuroscience and artificial intelligence and network theory?
So on the neuroscience side, one of the main roles will be in helping to interpret data in terms of computational theory. So to normalize the use of a whole set of really useful tools, like from classifiers and clustering and so on, things need to apply to these large scale data and show how they can be used to answer computational questions. So providing that bridge between the experimental neuroscientist and the computational literature. Mm-hmm. And then on the, I guess on the other side, then yes, it is incumbent upon the neural data scientist to try and keep up a bit with what's going on in the AI and machine learning fields. See, depending on what your preferred focus is. So obviously, so some like Conrad Cording, clearly keeping up a lot on the deep neural network AI side, mm-hmm. and us doing a lot more unsupervised learning stuff, keeping on top of the machine learning and network theory literature as much as you can, given the vast output of these fields.
Oh, yeah.
But that's where the richness of the interaction comes from. So obviously the in AI and in machine learning fields, obviously there are many, many great ideas constantly being produced and output, but in the form of we have this great idea, we apply this to some sample test data or benchmark data, and we move on to the next thing. So it's our job to find out how these techniques could be used to answer scientific questions and translate them across to neuroscience.
Very good. Well, Mark Humphreys, thanks for being with me today, and continued fortune on your journal output and also on your Medium blog. I appreciate you writing, and it speaks to the idea that you'll be giving those Christmas lectures one day because you're good at communicating what you do. So I appreciate you being with me.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. Thank you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed Mark as I did. I actually got chills when he said that he wants to have that beautiful idea. I think it's something that we should all strive for, all the while remembering it's a process. And if you're doing it right, it's a big, messy process with lots of beautiful failure to go with it. So keep working on whatever it is you work on. Questions, suggestions, connect with me on Twitter at PGMID, PGMID, or send an email to paul@braininspired.co. Again, visit the show notes on the website for links to what we talked about. Go to braininspired.co. Thanks for listening.